It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Jeff Jarvis has the week off, but don't worry. We're going to have a great conversation with Kevin Marks and Matthew Ingram. The Google car crashes, but it's good. That's a good thing. We'll talk about that and a lot more next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly, CacheFly.com. Hi, everybody. It's time for our annual audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It helps us understand our audience better, know what you like and don't like, how you listen to the show. It also helps us tell advertisers what kind of people listen. But I promise you, your feedback is always kept personally anonymous. All you have to do is visit twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. It'll just take a few minutes, and it'll help us make Twit even better. We really appreciate your support and any help you can give us. twit.tv/survey. This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 342, recorded Wednesday, March 2nd, 2016. Hit it right in the joint. This Week at Google is brought to you by Squarespace. Make your business and online store stand out with the only platform that lets you create, manage, and brand your store in a beautiful way. Enter the offer code TWIG and get 10% off Squarespace. You should. And by Carbonite. Keep your business safe this year. Protect files on your computer or server with automatic cloud backup from Carbonite. Try it free without a credit card at Carbonite.com today. And don't forget to use the offer code TWIG to get 2 free bonus months if you decide to buy. And by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at FreshBooks.com/TWIG. It's time for TWIG, This Week in Google. The show where we talk about, well, actually we have a new tagline thanks to our producer Jason Kleanthis. He proposes, we'll talk about it. If you can Google it, we'll talk about it. I like it. That's Matthew Ingram chortling in Florida. You got a tan. I've never seen Matthew Ingram with a tan.
Hey, we get tans in Canada, too.
Yeah, but not all. Not, you have a very brief window.
Yeah.
It's great to see you from Fortune.
Very long days in the summer.
Yeah. And there he is in his garden with his orange trees. Kevin Marks showing off his California backyard.
There we go.
Jeff Jarvis has the week off, but I think we'll muddle through with these two great minds. It's always a pleasure to have you both. Thanks for joining us. And it really is true that this show has not restricted itself to Google in a long time, if ever. But it's when you get great people together to talk about, you know, technology. One of the things I was asking before the show, Kevin Marks, of course, one of the mavens behind the indie web camp and the indie web movement, the idea of, you know, the web for the rest of us. One of the guests we had on this week on our Triangulation show was the inventor of the wiki, Ward Cunningham, and his newest effort, the Federated Wiki, which is a really interesting idea that if it baffles you, Kevin Marks, well over my head, but it was an indie web camp.
I was shown it at indie web camp, and it was one of the things that when Ward shows you, I think that makes a certain amount of sense. I can see what I can do with this, and then I installed it on my own site. So I've got wiki.kevinmarks.com. Then I haven't actually used it, so it's been sitting there for a couple of years, and I've been going, and I've never I don't think to go there, which is interesting. And I think the challenge with wikis is that wikis. You can use a wiki on your own, and I have friends who do, but it makes much more sense when you're using it with a group of other people to curate something. So yeah. Like indiewebcamp.com is a wiki. And basically the way we run that community is a mixture of continuous chat that we have in IRC and on the web and in Slack, all mirrored to each other, and a wiki to collect the stuff that should be a bit more permanent. So we can chat about stuff, and then when somebody has something that makes sense to preserve, or when somebody asks a question, we answer it. We preserve the answer on the wiki, so the wiki becomes this sort of community repository of knowledge.
That's cool, isn't it? I love wiki. I love the idea of wiki. One of the things I told Ward right away is this is, I think, really what Tim Berners-Lee's original conception of
of the web was a collaborative document with hyperlinks.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I had one that was all about me because I thought, well, A, because I'm fascinated with myself.
It's a great subject.
But I thought I could have a spot where instead of waiting for someone to do a bad wiki page for me, I could just create my own wiki and put a bunch of stuff in there. And if people wanted to look at it, they could. And it just, I don't know, there was no point to it in a way because there was no one else contributing.
Right.
I think to Kevin's point, it doesn't really become interesting until there's other people in there.
Right.
Or we got a reason to document it or do stuff with it. Yeah. I mean, Tantek Celik has his own wiki. Tantek, another...
I think that's where I got the idea.
Well, and I've used wiki. I for a long time, the radio show website was a wiki because I had this silly notion that the listeners of the radio show might want to go in there and contribute to it.
Did they?
But not so much. It was a lot of spam. And what I mean, of course, Wikipedia is the paragon of what wiki is all about. But you need a community around it and an active community. And people who will patrol it.
I actually started one when I was at the newspaper, the Globe and Mail. I don't know if you remember. I think it was it the LA Times? Someone tried a wiki editorial. Do you remember that? Years ago?
No. What an interesting idea.
It was an interesting idea and a total disaster.
Of course it was.
But they did that on purpose. I mean, that was their way.
Was it
the LA Times, wasn't it? And they said, basically, we're writing an editorial. It's a wiki just to show that wiki's a bad idea. That was my sense of it. Because
oh, really?
They didn't set up an editing thing. I mean, so it was a no, editorial should not be edited by the public.
They were right, because it was a disaster. But so I tried one when I was at the Globe. And what I wanted was people to discuss a specific topic. So if the newspaper was talking about the Middle East, I thought it'd be great to have kind of live, not a discussion so much as people contributing their thoughts or links or commentary that they found or interesting things. Because there's no real way to do that in a newspaper. You can have an op-ed piece and then maybe someone writes a letter. So I was exploring the sort of almost real time, but asynchronous contributions from readers. And it was fascinating because it wasn't a disaster, but it wasn't actually a huge success either. I got maybe a few thousand people contributing, but we got some really smart contributions that just never really kind of gained any steam. And then that was that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's always about, you know, work practices and whether you use it. So way back when I was at Apple, I set up a wiki for the QuickTime team internally inside the firewall.
Really?
Because wikis were cool, and we were getting fed up with mailing around Word documents to describe new features and things. So we built, and the PMs were grumpy because the engineers would never respond to their Word document emails. And so I set up a wiki for the QuickTime team so we could discuss, you know, upcoming features and things we wanted to do. And the engineers went into it and actually started documenting things, which made the PMs happy because they had something to read. So it was it worked fairly well for a bit. And then one day, my manager called me into his office and said, "That wiki you've set up, you need to put security on it." I said, "Did someone outside see our plans?" He said, "No, but the other group can see what we're thinking."
Well, there
Which
you go.
Which kind of sums up an Apple point of view.
Point. Yeah.
Yeah.
We had I had a wiki for our digital staff and sort of social media, and then some other department had a wiki, and then someone else had, you know, a doc, or they had Microsoft SharePoint or something. We could never get everyone on the same, using the same tool. So it was sort of duplicating things everywhere. Actually, the Federated Wiki would have worked really well for that.
I'm very intrigued by Wiki still, but Ward's particular iteration is interesting because of the federation, that the idea that the Wiki will live in multiple places, but then... Federation is a challenge because... for instance, there have been attempts to do federated Twitter. That's what Evan Padromo tried to do with app.net. And the notion, which it notionally seems like a great idea, is that there are multiple servers and that what you tweet to app.net on one server is then somehow migrated to the others.
Evans was something different, though. Evans wasn't app.net. Evans was...
Yeah, he was did app.net. They just renamed it to something else.
No, Evan Prodromo did...
Status.
Wasn't status. They changed it to StatusNet, but it was...
It was Identica, and then it was Status.net.
Identica, that's right.
Right. And now that code base is GNU Social, so that's been open sourced. And there is a fairly widespread federation of GNU Social instances, which is kind of fun.
I love it, and I love the idea, but I don't understand really
how it works.
Yeah, federation is bigger than my mind, I guess.
Well, it's not the way we think about.
Yeah, you think about site.
You're thinking about sites as being
silos.
Thing, right.
Well, that is the challenge. Site, yeah. So if you go to quitter.no or quitter.se, this is GNU Social fork with a skin that looks like Twitter, or looks like slightly retro Twitter.
You're losing your bandwidth here. Tell your daughter or your son to stop BitTorrenting.
My son's in London.
That's right. Well, he can't mess you up from there, I don't think. We're a federation of microbloggers, quitter.no, who care about social justice and solidarity and want to quit the centralized capitalist services. Yep. Power to the people.
So that's quitter.no. And it's just the thing is, Quitter.se did this. They took GNU Social, which looked like Identica did, and then they made a skin for it that makes it look like Twitter looks.
Looks so much like Twitter.
A few iterations ago. This isn't quite like
it's not
today Twitter.
Today's
this
Twitter.
Early Twitter.
And it's federated.
So if you go to. I'm going to do this logged out because I'm logged into mine. You get slightly different behavior.
This might be timely because I feel like the only thing keeping Twitter alive at this point is a lack of a reasonable alternative. You know what I mean? I love what Twitter does. I really do. And, you know, all you had to do is watch the Academy Awards on Sunday night. You better be watching it live, because if you're not, then Twitter will spoil the whole thing for you.
Yeah.
But if you're watching live and watching the tweets live, it's like sitting around with your friends.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
It's really fun. And so I love Twitter.
And the thing is that...
But it doesn't... But it has problems, right? I mean, it's not...
Well, it has... I mean,
part of the problems are because there's too many people.
Yeah,
Twitter was actually great when there were fewer people.
Right.
No, I think that's not it. I think I've written a long essay about this, but the thing is, Twitter actually worked as a place where different sets of people could coexist originally.
Yes.
Because you chose who you were following, and so what you primarily saw was the people you followed. Originally they had a public timeline, which the clones have now as well, but Twitter doesn't have that anymore because it would be too big. It would scroll past too fast to make sense of anything. But the primary thing you had on Twitter was a set of people you decided to follow, and it was a list of what they were saying, and that was what you saw. And then eventually they added @replies, but it was a separate thing you clicked to see responses to you. It was another column that was not the default view.
Yeah.
So your default view of Twitter was the set of people you'd chosen to see.
Right.
And that's still kind of true with Twitter.
It's rapidly becoming less
except
true.
Except they... when it became mobile and became an app and got notifications, they got very excited about notifications. And they said, oh, what can we notify people about? We wouldn't want to notify them every post. That would be annoying, though actually original Twitter would do that with SMS. That was part of the way it grew originally, was it would send you an SMS with every post. So it was mobile before everything else was mobile. This is like pre-iPhone. And then they let you turn that on and off. And then when it became an app, they made notifications out of the @replies.
Mm-hmm.
And originally, we still had the sort of conventions around @replies and how they behave from the previous model, which was that was a secondary thing you looked at. But gradually, the @replies become more important than the main feed.
Because that's where the conversation happens.
But also because it's notifying you. So one of the wonderful things about Twitter originally was it didn't have an unread count. It was just this thing you could dip into an apple.
It was a stream.
It was a stream, and you would, you know, it's like, oh, I've got 5 minutes in the the line at the shop.
Right.
I'll dip into Twitter for 5 minutes.
Right.
I'm waiting for a train. I'll dip into Twitter 5 minutes. There's no pressure, unlike email, because it doesn't say 27 unread or 2,500 unread if it's at my email. And then they once they added the notifications, they put an unread count on it. And so now if you've got an iPhone, you've got a big red number on your Twitter, which is all the at replies that, yeah. that you want. And they've made the at replies the most prominent thing about it. So they've taken what was a different space that had a very different social construct in it and made it back into an inbox. And the problem with inboxes is it prioritizes other people's agendas over your own. So if you've got an inbox and anyone can send you stuff, then they are sending you stuff and then they're putting stuff on your agenda. And so that was the basic problem of email, that anyone could send you stuff. And Twitter has sort of recapitulated that with at replies.
I think it actually got better. Like the at replies were actually part of what started getting me interested in Twitter. When it was just a stream, not that following people who I liked wasn't interesting, but the conversational aspect was what I became more interested in. And there was a brief kind of honeymoon period, you know, like Camelot or whatever, where there was just enough people with different interests to make an interesting conversation, but not enough people with dramatically different interests who could dive bomb your at mentions and create some of the social problems that we're having now.
But also the at mentions, first you had to click to get to them. They were a thing on the mm-hmm. side. And secondly, the initial at back and forth stuff you only saw if you were following both parties.
Right.
So they deliberately did that to stop everything being a flood of ads, because people found it, you know, if two of you get into a back and forth row, not necessarily everyone wants to see that. So that was part of the dampening thing. And the challenge with all these systems is bridging between the show me the stuff I've chosen to see right. and connect me to what's going on in the rest of the world. And that is always the back and forth we go to with all these systems. And so, you know, initially they had the public timeline and you could go there and get a gestalt of what was going on because there were only, you know, a few thousand of us in there and it wasn't changing that often. And if you look at these new social things, they have
those. Somebody get mad at me for retweeting something. Dude, I don't know if you remember, because retweets were new and I kept retweeting people, and this person got really mad, and they're like, why are you retweeting these things into my stream? I'm not interested in them.
Get your retweets out of my stream, man.
And I thought, well, this was actually what I thought was part of what was interesting, was people right. retweeting things that interested them. And he saw it as an intrusion on
his intrusion.
His
yeah.
feed.
Well, then he can unfollow you and go away. I mean, then that was the other point. The other point is that retweeting was an important piece of this, because retweeting was a way of amplifying something you saw that was good.
Right.
So it creates this signal that is useful and spreads it further. But it's a natural thing.
But it can go bad too, right?
It can go bad too.
Quote retweeting. I actually got called out by Chris Sacca, who called me the king of the witch hunt retweets. And for a second, I didn't even know what he was talking about. I thought, what does that even mean? But I think what he meant was me quote retweeting someone as though I was saying, hey, followers,
it was,
jump on
it was
this.
A pile on.
Right. Right. Which is not, well, okay, I've done that a couple times. But that's not typically what I do with a retweet.
Well, part of the retweet is, there's three gestures in Twitter now. There's the like, which is like, this is interesting, but also had a bunch of other nuances, and we got the star
heart
thing.
Part.
But then it was, you know, but you could see other people's list of likes. But then they started sending those notifications as well, or sending you, you know, eight friends of yours like this thing,
right.
and notifications and stuff like that. So they made that a higher stakes thing. There's the retweet, and there was the classic retweet where you actually had to do it by hand, and then there's the new retweet, which is a button that just basically puts that thing to the top of the post in your timeline, shows it to your followers,
right.
And brings it up to the top where people have already seen
Native
it. So that's a very useful way of restructuring the flow to give more weight to certain things. So, these things all end up, you know, somebody says something very witty or shocking, then you will retweet it and it'll go up there. And then the new one is the retweet quote, which is basically, what they've done is they've taken a thing that you could always do, which is point to another tweet, but they give you a preview of the tweet and they let you write above it. Mm-hmm. And so that, it doesn't thread like the back and forth at replies. So it's a way
of... You've gotten mad at me about that because it breaks the conversation.
It can break the conversation. I mean, but it's a way of responding to something for your audience, not for the person you're talking to. So it's basically you're quoting something. It's like doing a block quote of somebody and commenting on it, right, which is a classic thing.
Which you can do for a number of reasons. You can say, this is interesting, or this is dumb, or this is shocking. Like this, or I have something to add. I mean, if you get into a canoe, like a tweet, multiple tweets with multiple people, you get like 8 characters to put something in your tweet. Right. You can't really have a discussion.
But also, I mean, the other thing it's like is it's like quoting something on your own site, or, you know, it's making, you know, Facebook, when you quote something, you create a separate conversation thread for your followers.
Right.
You're not in the same thread as everyone else. And so if you do that kind of post, you're basically saying, let's talk about this amongst ourselves, kind of, except that the notification does go back to the person who you're quoting. So they can get dragged into your conversation, and then you can get the pylon problem. And the pylon problem is, you know, I'm holding this person up for sacrifice. I nominate you for the Hunger Games. You will be shouted at by my followers. And the reason that is a problem, and, you know, sometimes that is calling out, can you believe what politician X just said? And that is, you know, that is the purpose of it. But often it is, look at this idiot, let's all pile on him. And the reason those pylons are problematic is that they then become ways of destroying that person's Twitter experience and filling up their at replies with noise, which is the...
They can be, but I think that also, if you are genuinely trying to broaden a discussion, right, assuming that ever happens or anybody actually wants to do that, I mean, that's part of why I do those things, because I think there are probably other people who don't follow either one of us who may have some thoughts. So, but the problem is there's a sort of gray area between let's broaden the discussion and maybe people have some thoughts, and let me call out this person and the mob can take over. And there, and that sort of that gray area is where most of Twitter exists right now.
But the thing is, because, you know, so the structural thing of the at replies becoming notifications is the thing that makes that a toxic behavior. If you were just discussing it amongst your followers, then that would be, you know, a thing, and it may be, you know, you may be obnoxious, but you're not, at least you're not, like, it's not being thrown in the face of the person who you're talking about necessarily. They'd have to go and look for that. Whereas because of it would naturally dampen down. Whereas because of this structure, it actually feeds this thing and this sort of outgrouping and shouting at each other thing.
Well, and a lot of what I think Twitter, a lot of the things that Twitter has done to make these problems worse are things that the company did to try and boost engagement because it was trying to become more valuable and justify its, you know, IPO and so on. And so a lot of the things that were aimed at increasing engagement actually boosted the sort of pile-on problem.
Now, let's talk about an alternative, like GNU Social. Does this fix the problem, or is it just a... I'm sorry, I'm just wondering about GNU Social. Is this just a Twitter clone that replicates Twitter's problems, or does this fix those problems?
It ends up with a different set of problems, which is always fun to look at.
There's always a different set of problems.
Different problems.
So what happens is each of these... Basically, there is a bunch of separate sites, and you sign up for one of the sites.
I just signed up for Quitter.no, for instance, which seems to be the biggest of them, right?
I think Quitter.se may be bigger, but anyway, did you just sign up for it?
Yeah.
Okay. So if you look at the front page you've got now.
Yeah.
I
don't have a timeline because I'm not following anybody.
Okay, so you can follow me. I'm Kevin Marks on there. Who are you on there, Leo?
Leo Laporte. I'm the same everywhere as you are.
Okay, so I'll follow you on there.
So I'm going to search for Kevin Marks as I would on Twitter. I haven't customized my profile. I'm busy doing a show right now. But I was able to do this. Okay, there's Kevin. So I'll follow you. This looks very much like Twitter.
No, exactly. This skin is made to make it look exactly like Twitter.
And you probably can reskin it, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So now you've got, if you took your top left, you've got a timeline. Yeah. Click timeline, it'll be me.
Yeah. It'll just be, it's the Kevin Marks timeline. Actually, it isn't because you haven't tweeted since, maybe if I refresh it, it'll bring in your tweets.
Wait, so I need to write
you need to say can't something. Say I'll follow some more people. I presume I could follow Evan and a few more people. We ran a status net. It was Identica at the time. It was called the Twit Army for a while. And it was really cool to have our own Twitter. Now, Federation, often when people talk about Federation, they say, well, Twitter is not federated. Email is federated. Email is an example of a federated. So, now I see you, Kevin.
Okay, so you see you've got a timeline link.
Yeah.
Under that, you have a notifications link. Now, you click timeline. That's followings. Top left, timeline.
Timeline, yep.
So that's me.
Welcome to Twitter.
I'm in your timeline.
You said .com, but we won't. Nobody will quibble.
We won't quibble. If you look at notifications.
Can I, by the way, have they added editing of tweets? No, because it's federated. You wouldn't want to, right? Because it's too late.
Are they even tweets?
I'm sorry. What do they call them?
No.
Not GNUs.
So there's a debate about what to call them. They were calling them queets, which Q-U-E-T-S.
That's not good.
But it's not a good name.
No.
They're Swedish. They thought it was funny.
in the days of Identica, what do we call them? I'm trying to remember.
Dents.
Yeah, what were
dents.
They called?
They were called dents. That's right.
They're now talking about calling them quips.
Quips is good. Let's call them quips.
But then requip is a bit weird, but it's not
No, requips is exactly right.
Right. So quip is a fairly good name. Anyway.
And I'm going to email you one. That'll be called an equip.
Anyway, you've got a timeline.
Yeah.
You've got notifications, which should be one in there because I added you unless I got your name wrong.
Let's go look at notifications. Yes. That's correct. I see one.
Okay. And
I'm
then
on there too now.
You've got favorites.
Yeah.
Which is
nothing because I haven't faved you. Let me fave this here. Oh, they don't. They only have a star. They don't have a smiley. All right. No hearts. They're in, but now it's in my favorites. Yep.
But then you've got public timeline. So public timeline.
That's all the people. That's how I would find new people, right?
So click that.
Cory Doctorow's on here, so that's enough for me. It's loading. We've just brought, by the way, the web's administrators
just knocking this
are going. What's going on?
Yeah, this is going to be bad. Yeah, they'll probably shut down registrations for a bit. Anyway, so public timeline is all the people who have accounts on this server.
On this server. That's important. This server.
Yes.
Okay.
Whereas there's a thing under that called the whole known network.
Ooh.
Which is not related to known with known.com.
Right.
This is just an unfortunate name. What that is not just everyone on this server, but also all the people on other servers that the people on this server follow.
Right.
So that is actually bigger. And what you were saying.
Oh, wait a minute. Now, wait a minute, though. It's not the whole known network. It's the network, the GNU social network that is contains people followed by people on Quitter.no.
Yes.
Important distinction.
Yes. It's not everyone.
But that's actually good because what you're getting is if you've got this social network that's Quitter, you're getting people that other Quitters are interested in.
Yes. So the thing is, you can see, what I'm seeing on this one is something in Greeks.
Yeah. It's very international.
A bunch of other stuff going on.
As it should be.
But if you actually hover over them, you can see that some of them are on different servers. So they're at Quitter.se. They're at, where's that one? Someone's local.
You can even go to the original quip. I like it. They're calling them quips.
So you can go through to these other servers.
Yeah.
So there is some federation between them. Yeah. There's also a sense that each of the servers has its own house style, and you join a server where the public timeline makes sense to you.
Should you run your own server?
You can do. It's up to you.
I mean, you can, but should you?
It's like running your own wiki. It's like if you've got a set of people that would make sense to, you can do that. If you just want to have a place that's all yours, you can do that too. It's up to you.
And then if you tweet on, Quip on your server, it would federate to other servers? So if somebody could follow you. So what's my namespace? It would be the name of my server.
Yes.
It would be Leo Laporte at this server name.
At Quitter.no, yes.
Yeah. And then if somebody followed Leo Laporte at Quitter.no on another server, so that's how it federates.
They would federate. They would get the federated updates, and it would also add you to the whole known network on that server.
Yeah, got it.
Is there any way I can tweet and also have that appear on Twitter?
There are ways to do that that I won't go into, but yes, you can do this.
And vice versa, right? I could post on, more to the point, I could post on my, what I really want to do is run the server locally, my have mine own, that federates and also can then syndicate. In other words, I want a with known. I want a known for Twitter. For Twitter, right. For GNU Social. Can we get Ben and Aaron working on that?
I tried using app.net. I tried using Identica. I was on app.net for a considerable amount of time.
But there's nobody there. There was no presence.
Not nobody. There were people there.
Yeah.
And I did do some cross-posting, and I actually got yelled at for cross-posting from Twitter.
There's zealots everywhere, aren't there?
But so then you're creating.
Well, so what we find with this is that the different sites have different personalities.
Yes.
There's.
But the problem is network effects. So everybody I know or want to interact with is on Twitter,
right?
Virtually, almost everyone. So then now I've got a separate place that I have to go to.
It's the same reason I use Facebook Messenger, because everybody I want to message is on there, but prefer Telegram. Because I like it better, and it's not.
And this is why Twitter, Facebook. Like even while Twitter was going through,
that's why it continues.
All the problems of it's going down all the time. It was, and they keep adding dumb features, and people just keep using it because everyone they want to interact with is there.
Patterson in our chat room says he just wants a CB radio for the internet, but you know I kind of understand that. That's kind of what this is, isn't it?
And it would be nice if Twitter were a little more open with its API. Maybe you could make it easier to federate from Twitter and to Twitter.
Yeah.
But I don't see any chance of that happening.
Well, the challenge you see with these is that they all end up with different personalities.
Right.
And so they get grumpy if you put things in their public timeline you don't want.
Right.
So there's...
Well, that's the interesting thing. See, nobody follows the public timeline on Twitter. That is the timeline of every post. First of all, because it goes by a mile a second. But on these, they're smaller. It is very common. We found this on ours as well, that on the Twit Army Identica, everybody would follow the timeline. That's what you would mostly visit is all posts.
And I remember doing that on Twitter, too. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I remember doing that in 2007 on Twitter.
No, but it's one of the things that makes sense at different scales is that you're able to follow the whole public time in one of these, and it makes sense at that scale. And they have, there's other ones like there's clion.club, and there's other ones that are designed for people to be trolls on. And
Sea Lion. Nice.
And like talk about trollish things. And that has a very different flavor to it than. And you probably don't want to put that one on the screen, come to think of it.
So what?
let's go there now.
What flavor would that be? Let's go
there now. Actually, believe it or not, I can't even follow my own timeline. So all the people that I follow, I cannot look at that timeline because it goes by too quickly because I'm following too many people. So all I do is use lists. I gave up.
Yeah.
I mean, I should just unfollow a bunch of people, but that would take so long. So now I just use lists, and if it wasn't for lists, I wouldn't probably be able to use.
But this is the problem. I mean, it's this place is so crowded, nobody goes there anymore. Problem, which is
just too popular.
But it's also the sense. It's the balance between the chosen conversation and the public space, and the bridges between the two. And sort of the bridges between the two are these. At replies that connect things, and that they can be toxic. It's also the hashtags that connect things, which bridges across. So you can put hash Oscars in, and then you can all be talking about the Oscars at once, and you couldn't follow that whole tag on some site. But you could follow. But you could follow if amongst your followers, they would actually make some sense potentially. Just watching your stream of followers discuss that the public event can be a useful thing as well. So it is the challenge of bridging these things together. But the hard part about it is you're really talking about social dynamics and how they get interacted with by software.
What fascinates me, I had this conversation earlier today. This has been going on for some time, but the discussion was about how part of the problem with Twitter is that it's not really... It's sort of verbal, so sort of like conversation, and yet it's sort of like publishing, right? So it's actually good and bad parts come from mushing both of those things together.
Yes.
So it's a little like having a discussion with people in a bar, but then it's also...
But those discussions are preserved forever and thoroughly analyzed and create outrage.
And... So when you say something dumb in a bar because you're drunk...
Everybody understands. Whatever,
right. No one like writes it down and then hands it out to everybody so that or publishes it in the newspaper. Right. I found it fascinating that Mark Andreessen left Twitter for... In fact,
in chagrin and embarrassment,
still hasn't tweeted.
No, he tweeted once. He
congratulated
a benign,
because
tweet.
Of a tweet. This man, Facebook had to apologize to an entire country.
Yeah,
and so did Mark Andreessen because of a tweet.
Yeah, that's the power of the Twitter.
Well, that's I mean, that's
good or ill.
It's something he said. If he had said it to you and I, you know, or even in a in a public place. It would not have had lived on.
Right.
But if he said in a public place, somebody would have written it down, too. You know, he's enough for a public figure that was true. But But yeah,
There's that PR person who made a vaguely racist comment before she got on the plane to South Africa and had been fired by the time the plane landed.
Yeah.
She wasn't famous.
Part of what we're trying to figure out is how does that change your behavior if the things you say, things you just shoot your mouth off or you're tired or you haven't thought about something properly or you're had too many drinks. What happens when those things take on the power of basically publishing?
I've said extraordinarily dumb things on Twitter. I've hurt friends. There have been consequences many times. And you hope you learn your lesson, but it really is, it's very easy to say things on Twitter that you deeply regret.
Because it feels like you're not, it feels so inconsequential.
Informal. Yeah. It's not.
So informal.
Originally, you know, I wrote a thing about this in 2009 or something, where I was hopeful for the future of Twitter because your mental model when you're reading Twitter is the set of people you follow.
Right.
So you see the set of things that people you follow say, and you respond to those, and you're having a conversation with that audience, except your audience is actually the people who follow you, which is a different set of people. And they're, you know, they probably overlap, but and the thing is, if those things are all soft overlaps, then that can work very well as a way of ideas sharing and some of them being amplified and some of them being dampened and so on. The problem comes when people start outgrouping each other and using it to fight other wars and fight battles between people. And so rather than following the set of people that they want to follow, they will go and find people who say things they disagree with and argue with them because they know that if they at reply them, that will get into their face. Right. One of the, somebody in the channel was saying, I like sending gay porn images to a leaf. And it's like, yes, I can think you probably do like doing that, but that isn't actually going to change his mind at all.
No, it's just going to annoy him.
It's his position. Yeah. And he'll say, look at these people. They're terrible. Look at these things they're doing.
Right.
And it goes back and forth and amplifies the thing. It doesn't actually contribute to the discourse. So the easiest way to build a group is to find somebody who isn't in the group, point to them and say, look at them over there, aren't they terrible? And that reinforces the group. And the challenge for Twitter is to reinforce the in-grouping rather than the out-grouping. And originally they were partly this was an outgrowth of how it was originally built and the social structure it built, partly because it was built by people who were activists, like Rabble and Blaine, who had thought about this stuff. And then, as you say, it gradually got sort of, we've got to increase engagement, And the easiest kind of engagement to increase is people shouting at each other, because once you start doing that, it's hard to stop. So once somebody says the homophobic thing, and this chap sends him gay porn, and they start shouting at each other. It's going to be very hard to get closer to a
discussion again. Very obvious kind of incentives. I don't know whether they did this deliberately or whether it just happened, because it's one of the things about Twitter is it's impossible to know what was planned and what wasn't, because so much of what it's become was totally unplanned. The incentives are, you see... you know, the likes, or you see the retweets, or you see and you get a little endorphin rush, right? Yeah. Every time, I said something funny. And so you maybe push it a little bit further, or maybe because you want that. That actually encourages bad behavior just as much as it encourages good behavior.
Yes.
Well, I don't know. you know, I don't know what to do.
How do we fix it?
I feel like if there were a solid alternative to Twitter, that the people would be glad to go to it.
They would not.
You don't think so? Because there's nobody there.
That's the problem you have to get over. I think all of these things have been, they're great alternatives. Lots of them have great features.
Yeah.
And the Federation is a great idea, but there is nothing. If people were going to do that, they would have done it by now. Yeah. There's nothing that is going to move people, enough people off that or off Facebook to some other network. I don't see what could possibly offer that would make people do that.
Well, I mean, you know, you can say that, but this has happened before. We could have said that about MySpace.
You
know, 5 years ago. Who could actually get us to the scale of MySpace? So people, these things grow exponentially, and then they collapse fast, too, when people start leaving them. And Twitter's fear is that they're in that state now. That post from Julianne and Moore...
Zero growth, yeah.
Was saying...
Boobs Radley, yeah.
Boobs Radley. It's like... not Julianne Moore, Julianne. No, God, I lost name. Sorry, Julianne. We'll look up a real nice minute. But she's saying it's like... It feels like Julianne Smolinski. It feels like I'm going through the neglected park now, and it used to be this nice place, and now I have to hold my purse carefully to myself as I walk through it, and it stopped being nice, and that is the problem that it has become. And part of that is that they coasted for a while on the initial culture, which was this sharing culture, following people you knew or were interested in, not necessarily knew. And having that back and forth with them that was somewhat dampened because it took some work to find who was replying to and go back and forth. Yeah. And by amplifying that feedback loop, they've flipped the culture of Twitter to the point where Twitter is now synonymous with shouting abuse in public.
Right.
If Twitter is mentioned in popular culture, they're either saying, you know, tweet to save the person on American Idol or whatever, or they're describing it as a byword for people shouting at each other. And that's the piece they've got to fix, and that's going to be hard to fix because they need to adjust the technology such that the app replies aren't the most important thing in the app again. Rather than having an algorithmic filter on the timeline, you need an algorithmic filter on the app replies. So it's like, I should probably see app replies from people that I'm already having a conversation with over random drive-by people who are shouting at me because I mentioned Bernie Sanders or something. So I mentioned a keyword that somebody decided to go and shout about today.
But
the structural thing they need to think about there is changing the culture to back to this culture that reinforces in-group discussion rather than out-group shouting.
I think that could actually make it worse as well, but in a different way. Because I think we've had
this is the food battle argument, sure.
But so if it encourages you to just talk to people you're already connected to and agree with, then you're missing out on one of the biggest sort of potential benefits of having a broad network like that. But the problem is and this happens with comments as well, which I've looked at a lot, that if you want a low barrier to entry, right? You want to lower kind of the obstructions to people interacting because that's where you get a lot of the benefits. But as soon as you lower those barriers or make it easier to do those things, then you get lots of trolls and morons. So you can't actually have one without the other. You can't get something without giving something up. So, you know, Twitter's big issue is what are you prepared to do that will actually give up a certain amount of growth or engagement in return for these other benefits, and then users would have to make the same, you know, choice.
But the point is that it's more that you have to model the engagement better. So if you're just modeling it on number of tweets sent and number of people signed up, then you're actually modeling people shouting at each other and creating spam accounts to shout at each other more, and creating assuming that's a positive value.
Agreed.
So actually, what you mean is in a mill. Or nuanced metric, which is there actually useful conversation going on here? You know, when they Twitter said that, Well, that's the problem. First of all, you ask people. You do some qualitative stuff first. And if you do a qualitative survey of Twitter, you will get the answers from Julian Smolensky's asker, which is, it doesn't feel comfortable anymore. I feel like I have to back away from it. And that is the qualitative answer. You need to say, okay, what is causing that? What are things we can do to fix that? And the answer is, make it closer to the things you choose to see. You know, basically, it's swung too far into the public shouting space as opposed to the filter bubble. The big fear 5 years ago was, we're building filter bubbles. We're only going to see our own corner of the world. Actually, what we ended up building was the filter bubble where they gather together and then go and attack the other filter bubble and shout at each other. And that's the game of it. And, you know, yes, this is as old as the internet. This is the Usenet, the original Usenet raid on rec.pets or whatever. You know, yes, it's a structural problem. It's a problem we've had with email. It's a problem we've had with blog comments, and the reason people fear those, we've had it with YouTube comments. And the problem is always that.
But who's been able to fix it?
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Has
Twitter
anyone
was
been able to fix it?
Twitter did. Twitter early on was a better space for this. The reason Twitter took off was that you were able to have. As a sort of public figure, or, you know, in the sense of a journalist or even, you know, a famous person, you were able to have a conversation on there with other people that wasn't swamped by the replies. Now,
but I don't
part
think
of,
it's just the
part
technical
of what they built with the,
it's
but no, no
volume, it, right? It's just the sheer volume of people.
It's both.
Maybe the solution is for people who are fleeing Twitter to use Twitter as a read-only public broadcast medium, and then have their conversations in a quieter place like Quitter.no or Quitter.se or GNU Social somewhere. What about that?
Doing that with DMs. I mean,
yeah, DMs become your private area.
Right. Your private discussion area, and then you sort of withdraw as
much. I kind of regret, though, that we can't have a commons of some kind.
That is the rise of Slack.
Yeah, but Slack is now starting to get. I see a lot of posts all of a sudden, people saying, "Oh, great! I just replaced my inbox with Slack, which is now turned into my inbox."
Yeah,
right. No, and it is the same notification issue again, except that I've now got 27 inboxes, because I'm 27 Slacks or whatever. Mm-hmm. Sure, and yes, it is the problem of success.
There's too many damn people on this planet. That's the real problem.
Well, that is the problem. There are too many people. There is you cannot follow everyone. You cannot have every contribution to the discourse on the same page. It just doesn't make sense.
Right.
And these things are powered or distributed. So what works for one end of the tail, where there's, you know, a small conversation, doesn't work at the other end of the tail, where 1,000 people are in the trying to be in the conversation, and 500 of them are making the same lame joke, and 250 of them are shouting abuse.
Clashing sort of, not worldviews, that's too grandiose a term, but so like filter bubbles, I guess, but bubbles running into bubbles. So you and all your tech friends think this thing is hilarious, and so you make fun of it. But that thing happens to be racist, or it's offensive to someone in some way that you haven't thought of, because all of you think it's hysterical. And so then those things clashing into each other creates, you know, if it was just you guys going bowling and talking about this thing, it probably wouldn't turn into anything.
That's what Twitter used to be, right? Things, what you had for lunch.
When all of those things are happening out in public, then it becomes you shouting obscenities or offensive things instead of you just doing it with your buddies.
What does GNU Social do about harassment? I mean, do they have tools built in? This is the other complaint, of course, about Twitter, is they've become a wonderful platform for harassment.
That's the thing, is that the harassment comes with the at replies.
Right.
If I'm just writing horrible things about Leo somewhere on my own blog and they're not being sent to you, that's much less of a problem.
Right. By the way, that was Twitter's response. You're being harassed. Well, just mute them.
Right.
But that doesn't stop people doing it.
So what happens is whoever's running the individual server has some tools of it, because they're the server admins. So they can kick accounts off. Mm-hmm. They can put blocks on them. The challenge is, in this whole no network view, if I follow someone on another server that is posting offensive things, that will show up in that view on this server. And so then they have to do a federation block on that server, or they have to block accounts on that. So there are some tools for doing that. And this has come up recently amongst, because a bunch of Gamergate types have been setting up new social servers to argue with the other new social servers. And
that didn't take long.
And then they say, well, you can post what you like, just don't post porn on this. And then someone says, well, I'm going to post porn on this. And then, and then they set up a server for posting porn, and then they follow them on the other server. And, so, basically, if people have decided to mess with you, then federation is hard and you have to start putting filters in place. The challenge is, are you trying to do this for everyone on Earth, which is Twitter's problem and why it's hard, or can you do it locally within one server? So when there was a lot of fuss from the Breitbart lot on Twitter about being banned and so on, a bunch of them went to Quitter.se and said, okay, we're going to create accounts here.
No, really?
And the Quitter.se people said, no, we don't want you here. We don't like your politics. If go and set your own one up if you want to have one. And then that disclaimer they put on the top about we believe in social justice and linking the Communist Manifesto and things was their way of saying, actually, right-wingers, we don't want you on this server. If you want
that's recent. They've added that.
So it's a few months old or something.
Right.
So the thing there is you can exclude the bubble and then you can follow across the bubble, but then the admins... If people start trying to troll each other, then it creates problems for the admins. And I follow a bunch of the admins on different servers and see the problems they're having with this, and trying to work this stuff out.
So should Kanye create his own GNU social?
He totally could.
Kanye, not no.
He's the best thing about Twitter.
Yeah,
like the guy just goes mental, and everyone enjoys watching him. And I know Twitter probably thinks that this is great because it.
Oh, it's great for Twitter. Are you kidding? Yeah.
But I think to Kevin's point, Twitter has effectively created this problem, and I don't see how they get out of it. So they, they're a public company. The stock tanked by like 60% or something. I don't know what it is now, but I mean, it's lost billions and billions of dollars worth of market value that it once had. User growth has slowed to a trickle, if at all. And I realize there's a lot more people who don't sign in. That was Fred Wilson's argument the other day. And that is a huge part of the way people use Twitter. But so you've got to...
Wait a minute. Say that again. Don't sign in.
Yeah, they're not...
And it really is read-only, and there's no at replies because you don't have an account.
Yeah. Right. So but then you're... then
a lot of...
But then you've got to know someone's name, or you're clicking on... what do you call them? Moments.
Spam? Oh, moments. Yeah, moments. Love that moment.
So then, and obviously the value of those people, I think, is lower, but regardless. So Twitter's this public entity, right? But user growth isn't increasing, which when you're a public company is bad. Something is not growing. It might as well be shrinking.
In real life, we have a variety
of things. How do they fix the problems, but still, create more value without making the problems worse?
Right. In real life, we have a diversity of spaces. We have very public spaces where people act out, and we have private spaces. And sometimes you want just a conversation in a quiet neighborhood pub, and sometimes you want to go to the stadium. Right. And we can have those experiences. Can we not do that in digital, or does digital... Or is there something that is more digital native than that? I mean, I don't like it when we try to glom real world experiences into digital experiences. But
well, I feel like Kevin's right in a way that Twitter could have had more a more sort of fluid, small, not so small, a little bit larger, everybody kind of experience.
Right.
And now you just have DMs or.
Right.
You're talking to the football stadium.
Right.
And maybe if they had tried a little harder along the way, they could have created some of those different ways of having that and not incentivized the bad behavior.
Let's take a break because we got to move on. But I think a great discussion. And
This Week in Twitter.
This Week in Twitter. I told you at the beginning, it's anything you can Google is the subject of the show. No, Twitter has always been, this has always been the show about Twitter, Facebook, and Google, not just Google. And it's just kind of historically called This Week in Google. But really, it's really about the internet as it's evolving. I wonder if Google Plus could have become that space. I feel so sad about what happened with Google Plus. It just kind of...
The circles was an interesting...
They were attempting to do something, weren't they?
That was the point of the circles. The idea of the circles was you create subsets of things to look into, and it was like a smarter version of lists.
Right.
But it was also a sense of you were publishing to that subset of people. And the challenge of it is, how do you model those?
It's not just that. Lots of people didn't do it. Some huge proportion of people just
because no one wants to spend the energy to make circles. That's a lot. Zuckerberg said no one wants to make lists.
And he's right.
Yeah.
He's right. Very few people are going to take the time to do that.
You know, Facebook has lists. Facebook has
I know. Like, it was the irony was that he said that even though they had lists. But I bet you he knows because they have lists how few people really use them.
Right.
No, but what they have is they have like chat subgroups. So the way Facebook structures this is you build a set of people you're chatting to.
What is, before we wrap this up, what is the style of Quitter.no? I mean... You said each kind of one of these GNU social sites has its own kind of style.
And it's a
Programmers? Is it open source folks?
It's sort of kind of, I don't know, it's like Norwegian social justice people. That was the original
I love that.
That's a small niche.
That's who I want to hang out with. I want more of those. All right, we're going to take a break. And return with actual Google news. But first, the Google car gets in its first accident caused by the Google car. And Brad Templeton, who is a autonomous vehicle guru and a celebrant, says, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. Our show today brought to you by our friends at Squarespace. This is where I live. This is where my site is on the web, leoville.com, because it is beautiful. It's so easy to make a good-looking site. I wanted to make a cover page, you know, and I did that. And then I thought, well, I ought to put my blog here. I moved my blog over. And then I thought, oh, well, you know, my photos should live here. And all of a sudden, the stuff I care most about, that's on Squarespace.com. Squarespace is the place to make your next website, whether it's a cover page, a blog, a portfolio. If you're a band, you'll love the templates for bands. They include tour dates, and you can sell your digital content or your CDs, for that matter. Because every Squarespace site has commerce built in, and not just any old commerce. It's not some, you know, afterthought hanging off the side of your site. It is your site. It looks, it fits and looks like your site. So it's all part of the seamless experience for your users. Mobile, too, built in. Every site is mobile responsive, so you don't have to worry about what size images you upload. It's all automatically handled for you, so your site looks good on anything from a 4-inch screen to a 400-inch screen. Squarespace.com. All your data is safe because Squarespace runs the servers and the software. It's automatically updated to be 100% secure. I've never seen a Squarespace server go down. That's the very tight integration they have between the software and the sites and the software and the hosting. I can go on and on. The new Squarespace Commerce lets you fulfill orders, manage product inventory, resolve customer issues, and you can even do that right from your iOS or Android device because they have these great apps. You get a free domain name when you purchase a year subscription. That's the most economical way. And you see, it is very economical to have a Squarespace site. Your site will look like it's been designed by a pro because it has been. The best designers, the best engineering go into every Squarespace template, and then you customize it to fit your aesthetics. And support, if you need it, 24/7, right from their Squarespace offices. Look, I want you to try it free. Go to squarespace.com, use the offer code TWIG, and you'll get 10% off, and you'll be showing your support for the show. Squarespace.com, offer code TWIG for 10% off. Just start with a cover page. See how you like it. That's what got me sucked in. Squarespace, you should. I'm actually liking Quitter.no. I'm posting some stuff up there. Customized my little profile. Followed Kevin Matthew. So the Google self-driving car It was the Lexus. It was the big one, not the little one without pedals and steering wheel. So there was a driver behind the wheel. Struck a bus in California on Valentine's Day. It was in Mountain View. It was on the city streets. It was an interesting situation, and it's kind of an interesting, test of the software. Mm. So they're coming up to a red light, and the car wants to make a right turn. So as it would, it's instructed to, it gets in the as far right as it can, so it can make the right turn. But then there's a storm drain with sandbags around it in that lane. So the car correctly senses the storm drain and the sandbags and stops. Now the light turns green. The car is stuck behind, stymied. So it's going to pull around the sandbags and get into the next lane over. Unfortunately, that lane occupied by a city bus. The vehicle's operator saw the bus approaching, but, quote, believed the bus would stop or allow the Google autonomous vehicle to continue. About 3 seconds later, it hit the bus. Now, it was only going 2 miles an hour. The bus was going about 15 miles an hour.
But this is a classic human being thing, right? You
expect it to let
right,
you in.
You try to move, and you're like, dude, why are you not letting me in? You
don't, I mean, don't you? Obviously. I don't know what you do in Canada, but right. But don't you just kind of start to edge in and just say you're going to have to? He's going to have to stop.
Right, and so you expect the other person to look at what you're doing and then decide. So for whatever reason, the Google bus or the bus decided.
You look like a funny vehicle. Maybe the bus looked at it and said, hey, you got LiDAR. You don't, I don't need to let you in.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, so there's a post I put in from Autoblog from September saying Google was trying to make the self-driving cars more aggressive because other drivers were confused by how they behaved on the road because they were too timid.
Right.
Now, my suspicion is that any Mountain View bus driver has seen these things for years and knows that they'll get out of his way. Because exactly. That's how they have been. They have been very rule-following. And so the bus driver was like, oh, it's one of those things. Well, I can carry on through because they always get out of my way.
But it didn't.
Because they made them a little bit more aggressive because they're trying to make it drive more like a human. But I suspect the other thing is they probably haven't thought through this whole how big is the thing I'm trying to cut off problem. Mm-hmm. Which is that if it's a bus, if it's a truck, you don't play that game.
No, exactly.
Yeah, humans do that.
Which is it's what human beings do, right?
Humans, no. You don't get in front of a bus. Those guys are nuts.
They don't care.
Right. But also, it's a matter of physics. It's like that thing cannot stop very easily. Right. There was this whole stupid...
You know, it wasn't just a bus. It was an articulated bus, ones with the joints in the middle. Okay. It was a big
those
bus.
Are big.
It hit it, by the way. It hit it right in the joint.
Right. So I originally thought this was like one of the little tiny Google things, which I would totally understand the bus like trying to cut that off.
That was a Lexus.
I didn't realize it was the medium-sized Lexus one. But the point is that...
makes perfect sense. What you just said, Kevin, now explains the whole thing. You're the first to explain this. Because there's nothing worse than getting to like... In California, we have these things called four-way stops. Yep. And it's got arcane rules about what happens at a four-way stop. First person, it's straightforward. If people arrive in order, the first person gets to go. But if people arrive simultaneously, you have to defer to the person on your right, and it's a weird situation. Yeah. And the most annoying thing that can happen is some guy sitting there whose turn it is going, no, you go.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
You go. That's like, no, follow the freaking rules.
Not, right, you're not playing the rules.
Which is what I do.
You're breaking the system by being, quote, polite. Oh, no, you go. No, you go.
I find it fascinating that Google is trying to find the right sort of algorithm for aggressiveness.
Isn't it interesting?
So you need to be a little bit aggressive, right? Because otherwise you start causing problems.
But the other challenge is the four-way stop thing is what you do is you make eye contact.
Right.
And if you're self-driving car,
you
can't look at them. You can't see if they've seen you. So you're relying on, are they moving or not? And they had another case they talked about a while back, which was somebody was on a fixie bike. And so on a fixie bike, you're not stationary at the stop. You're jiggling back and forth.
Yeah.
So he was jiggling back and forth waiting for the car to go, and the car was seeing him jiggling back and forth saying, oh, he's going, oh, he's going. It was like an impasse until
that's the thing. Nonverbal cues, right? Like, so if you're looking over your shoulder and you want, like, I would have looked at the bus and you'd be like, you know, like, could you? And then the bus driver would look at you and you would get the sense that he was the kind of bus driver who did not want to let you in. And then in a split second, you would kind of come to an agreement.
Here's what Brad Templeton wrote. I love Brad. Usenet pioneer, now in, very big into autonomous vehicles. He has a blog, Brad's Ideas, at the ideas.forbrad.com, number four. He writes, so why is this a good thing? Well, because Google's starting to work on problems like these, and you need to solve these problems to drive even in orderly like places like California. He talks about India, where there's the lane lines are purely a suggestion, and nobody pays any attention whatsoever. So he says to solve this problem, we have to come up with a resolution, get the computer to do the right thing. He says, in this case, Google says it learned that big vehicles are much less likely to yield.
He also says
it sounds like the vehicle's confusion of the sandbags probably made the bus driver decide the vehicle was stuck, right? Oh, he can't move. Nobody wants accidents. Some will play this accident as more than it is, but neither do we want so much caution that we never learn these lessons.
Right.
It's also a good reminder that Google, even though it's a clear leader in this space, still has lots of work to do. It's worth noting, and this is what you brought up, Kevin, that sometimes humans solve this problem by making eye contact to know, well, did he see me? Turns out robots can do that because the human eye flashes brightly in the red and infrared when looking at you. That's why you have red eye with a flash camera.
But you can't detect... Well,
you can know if he sees you.
Right, but it's another whole level to detect intent.
Yes, right? he says that.
And if you've driven anywhere in like in India or China or lots of places where traffic rules are just a suggestion, you govern yourself a lot by what the person, how are they looking?
Right.
Do they look aggressive?
Right.
So now the computer has to determine, does the bus driver look aggressive?
What a challenge. Right.
Well, so the pedestrian crossing thing in Ireland, if you make eye contact with the driver, then the driver says, well, you see me, so I can go. Whereas in California, if you make eye contact with the driver, you're basically saying, I want to go. And so that can cause a cultural collision as well. It's a different sense of how you behave in those circumstances.
When we moved to Edmonton, Alberta, we were from Toronto, where for Canadians, people are aggressive. Not like in lots of other places, but for Canadians. And so then we moved to Edmonton. If you even move towards, if you're walking, you move towards a roadway, cars will stop, even when there's no crosswalk, because they assume, oh, you're indicating a desire to cross. In Toronto, you just have to dodge your way around the cars. But they literally stop. And then you have to be like, no, I actually changed my mind. I don't want to cross the road. You go ahead.
Yeah. And that's, and you know, if you look at the visualizations they post for the Google thing, they draw little boxes around the pedestrians and the cyclists to decide where they're going to go, and then they don't cross those boxes. And so they are trying to work out if someone's trying to step off the curb or not all the time. Right. And it's, you know, and that's different.
I don't know why, but for some reason, looking at a picture of Market Street in the early 19th or 20th century.
Actually, if you look back.
Whoa, he's running in front of the streetcar. No, watch out. Here it comes.
if you look back at when cars first started driving, it was chaos.
Yeah.
Is that what this is?
This is video of a car, of the early cars on the Market Street, trying to navigate their around street cars, around horse-drawn carriages, and, of course, pedestrians who just don't know what to do with this thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And there were games people would play trying to rush in front of cars. And they had
the cable car, you know, it's not going to turn.
Yeah. Where'd you get that video, Jason Kleanthis? That's great. That's video.
Right. Just on YouTube. It's from Market Street 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Go back 100 years.
So, 1916, cars were very, very new. There were a few. And how people reacted was fascinating.
There was a huge legislative thing with jaywalking. And in fact, the car industry, as far as I've been able to gather, was actually pushing legislators to make jaywalking a crime because they didn't want cars to hit people, obviously. That's bad marketing. So jaywalking, there were people who were publicly defending the right of people to just cross roads whenever they wanted. And eventually, obviously, this all got sorted out, presumably by people getting run over.
Yeah. It has a remarkably salubrious effect on the body politic.
But, you know, Brad's right about you learn. Even people learn by having accidents. I've got three girls now who all drive. They've all had fender benders. They've all had sort of, you know, not big accidents, but things where they made an assumption, someone else made an assumption.
It's true. You have to
some extent, that's how you learn.
Yeah.
But the other thing is that you build a mental model of how cars behave. So if you're used to cars yielding for you, right. then you can be messed up by something that can't stop.
Exactly.
So the classic thing here is trains. People's intuitions about how cars and even buses behave are based on the fact that they can actually stop, whereas a train cannot stop. If you're trying to cross the Caltrain tracks, the train cannot stop if it sees you. It takes it half a mile to stop, and so it can't adjust itself to what you're doing. And there was a classic thing that they discovered where they were where they had railway lines and roads that crossed them at a level crossing. And they thought, oh, I know, we'll cut down the trees in between the two so that the cars be able to see the trains coming, and that way they'll stop and they won't try and get across. And what they found was if people could see the trains, they think, oh, I can make that.
I can make that.
And they kept getting hit by the trains.
I can make it.
So they put the trees back up so you couldn't see the train, and then people were more cautious. Because the problem is your intuition comes from other cars, and other cars can actually slow down.
The train's going 300 miles an hour.
Or train.
Yeah. Oh,
well, no, it's, you know, not in America. Oh, you know, if it's doing 50 miles an hour, you're lucky. Maybe 70 if the track's heavy. And I suppose the other thing is that if you see a train coming, you may be stuck there for half an hour as the damn freight goes past.
Yeah.
So that the other reason you try and get across in front of it. But you know, people's intuitions are wrong about these things because they've built them in one space and they try and apply them in the other. There was this whole big thing some middle of last year where people kept saying, making like trolley thought experiment things, you know, the trolley problem of do you divert the trolley to hit one person rather than five and all that thought experiment things. Yeah. And then they were saying, should your self-driving car drive you off the bridge to stop you hitting the school bus? And I'm like, have you guys seen a school bus? If a school bus hits your car, you're dead. The school bus is fine. You know, if you look up school bus car crash, what you see is destroyed cars and very large school buses that are completely fine because they weigh 15 tons and they can resist impact. You know, they don't have seatbelts in them because they can't stop that quickly. And that was the reason they built them like that. You know, they actually understood physics there. And this is the same, you know, this is an example of the same thing. It's like, there is a big piece of physics here, which is that thing is a large piece of metal that is moving faster than you, and you should get out of its way. And if you haven't actually factored that into your model, if you don't actually have an understanding of how different things on the road can accelerate and decelerate, you're going to get it wrong. So I suspect that's the piece that they're going to have to go back and build into this.
But the part that interests me more is how these robot cars and AI in general are going to build a sort of model of predictable human behavior based on facial gestures or finger gestures, or you know, how are they going to use kind of nonverbal cues and other things to determine the things that we naturally determine without even realizing it, probably.
Right. So that's the stuff we got on the screen, that they show them, they have an understanding and a projection of the vectors of the existing cars and how they're moving. And they project those forward, and they understand where there's a space that makes sense and where there isn't.
Yeah.
And they can cope with, they've got a compilation of weird random stuff we've seen on the road in Mountain View, like people driving the wrong way down the lane. Because there are some bits of Mountain View where you've got these six lane roads and you take the wrong junction and suddenly you're driving the wrong way down the road, and they've got, you know, motion capture of this, and they're like, okay, I will get out of the way of that thing until it comes the other way. So you're seeing it here. So they draw boxes around everything else on the road, and they draw these little fence things you can see there are then projecting somebody might cross here.
Wow. Look at that.
And so that they don't walk through those fences. That's their example of when to stop. And when they come up to a junction, they decide, am I safe to go or not based on, are these things here or not? And the challenge is, there are times, you know, Mountain View is a relatively easy place to navigate. You know, it's got wide roads, they've got wide lanes. There aren't that many pedestrians or cyclists except in a few little bits of it. Whereas if you try to navigate through Boston or London or, you know, Bombay or something, you would have to train it completely differently. And this is part of the problem they have. The other problem they have is Mountain View has a very lovely climate, like I'm sitting here.
Exactly.
These cars have not seen much rain. They've never seen any snow. They may have seen a little bit of snow because sometimes they've taken them to Tahoe or something, but it's not part of their... learned environment much. And they've got a big problem.
You could probably wipe out a quarter or more of the population of San Francisco simply by having a little snow. Because parking and driving on those hills, your life would change dramatically.
Yes. Well, and that's, the other thing is when it does rain here, the first rain of the autumn after it hasn't rained for 6 months,
mm-hmm, exactly.
Everyone crashes their car.
Mental. Yeah.
They don't, because they've forgotten how to drive in the rain. Also, all the water floods across the places and the traction goes.
And theoretically, this is where AI could come in really handy. Once cars build a model of one thing, they're not going to forget what it's like when it rains. They're not going to forget what it's like.
Yes, that's supposed to be the point. Yeah,
right. And if you've got cars like Uber, Tesla cars. Every Tesla car that is encountering something new is effectively building that database for all those other cars. So the more you have, presumably the smarter they get, faster.
Yeah, and that's supposed to be the point, is that each of them learns from each other, but mm-hmm. it also means they will all make the same mistake. So if one of them thinks it's time to ram buses, all of them think it's time to ram buses. And in this case, there was a complicated set of circumstances it was trying to solve, and it was an edge case that they hadn't found. There was a sort of a weird ad where Mercedes said, "We've driven 10,000 miles in our self-driving cars."
Right. Like,
that's nothing.
That's
yeah.
it.
Yeah, Google's done 100,000.
Like, I used to do that in a year.
Over a million now, yeah.
I used to do that in a year.
But it's like, Google's done over a million miles, and they've all learned from each other. The other thing is that and Brad's written about this a bit, I think, is that at the moment, these self-driving cars can only drive along roads that they've got properly mapped, which means a human has to have driven the LiDAR thing down that road first, so that they've actually got the sense of where all the lampposts and things are. But also, to some extent, I think they have to have driven it more than once, so that they've got at least a sense of which things are permanent, which things are temporary. Mm-hmm. So they're building the 3D model of what they're seeing, and they're mapping to a 3D model they've already established, so they understand what they're going to do within that space. And then
somebody fired up the BitTorrent again, Kevin. I'm going to have to interrupt you.
It's his wiki, I think.
It's that wiki going crazy. We're going to take a break anyway. It's a really fun conversation, of course, as always is when we get Kevin Martz and Matthew Ingram in the same room. And I'm glad you could be here for it. We'll have more with them in just a bit. Here's a video somebody in the chat room gave us of driving in an intersection in India. And you don't know how is this even, how come people, How they don't have a roundabout. They don't need it. We don't need no stinking roundabout. Just drive. Go where you think you need to be, and let the devil take the hindmost. Well, of course it's sped up, but
slightly sped up. But
I don't think it's that much. Yeah, you can see how close the pedestrians on the right come to getting clobbered. I mean, wow, just wow. Notice how easily the bus got through. By the way. Nobody gets in the way of the buses.
But this is it. But also, it's like they build up a line. So in theory, that's what traffic lights are doing. In practice, this is what these things do. It's like, okay, when there are eight of us here, then we get to go because we've now got enough.
I wonder if it's more efficient. I wonder if this is better than traffic lights.
It probably is. And yeah. not only that, I think it's. I think people learn different kinds of behavior. I had this discussion with somebody about when we were in Europe. We were talking about the driving where you shouldn't and in lanes where you're clearly not supposed to go. And his argument was that this was actually better than having too many rules and too many laws, because then people are more prepared for unpredictable.
They're paying attention.
Right. So they're paying attention because they know that car might just suddenly swerve.
Aneroid, who's in our chat room, who posted the link, says the per capita motor deaths in India are 16 times that of the UK. So it's not such a good idea.
Maybe not.
maybe it's not quite that good idea.
You've seen the comment about someone from the future, what did you do before self-driving cars? We just drove cars ourselves. But didn't millions of people die? Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's okay. That's part of the deal. That's how it is. I do remember being in Cairo and stunned by how the traffic is downtown Cairo. And somebody told me they had put in stoplights and it was such a mess because people just ignored them. So they just took them out.
Right.
They just took them out. It's like, that was a bad idea. They didn't work. So there you go.
Well, it's the roundabouts thing as well. It's like in the UK we have roundabouts.
I like roundabouts.
We do in Canada too.
Yeah, we're starting to do them here.
Stop sign junctions. Yeah, there are like, you know, there are a few over here. But the point is, there in the UK you will have them at the place that would be a four-way stop sign. Here would probably be a roundabout there a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But also they will have them at bigger junctions. So a junction like that, sort of one in India, would have a roundabout in the middle, and that forces you to actually. Basically, what it does is it turns a four-way junction into a series of three-way junctions. So it actually simplifies the calculation you're making, because your calculation is there someone coming from the left? Right. If there is, I'll wait. If there isn't, I can come into this thing. And then when you go out, can I get out onto the right here? And the bigger ones will have two lanes in the middle, and you can join multiple roads at a point. But the point is, the reason you put this giant circle in the middle is to reduce a complex junction into a series of smaller junctions. And that's the design process for it. And you'd think it would work here. I think the thing that's weird here is you have these. This is a computer controlled one. I've seen this before, but you have roads that look like this. You know, in England, you don't have 8-lane suburban roads.
Right.
You
barely. It's the same thing in France. That's right.
Part of it is a volume problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the reasons you need all these. You need all these traffic lights and lanes and things here is because the roads haven't been built that
right.
And that one of the interesting things in sort of urban design is rethinking that and restructuring the roads to, rather than having six 12-foot wide lanes, going down to fewer 10-foot wide lanes and a barrier and a bike lane, and then rethinking the junctions so that the bikes can actually turn without being hit by cars by putting pieces that are almost a roundabout in there as well. And there's a sort of growth of rethinking junction design and planning that has moved away from this, that, you know, the cars must move and the traffic lights will make them stop thing. The other weird thing here is that in California, it's rare to have traffic lights that understand that other junctions exist. They basically all operate independently. Whereas in Europe, they will phase them so that as you drive up to one, it will assume that if you drive through the speed limit to the next one, that one will then be green and you can go through.
They don't do
that in the US? It's rare. There's like three streets in San Francisco that do it. Most of them are autonomous junctions.
I think we have timed lights in many of our suburban areas.
Not so many.
You can go to Pine. You can go all the way up Pine if you time it right. All the way down Bush. There's certain streets.
Yes, there are, that's what I'm saying. There's two like thoroughfares that do that in San Francisco, it's not an assumed thing.
They figured it out in the suburbs.
But it's your use of space, right? In Europe,
use of space.
There's so little space in the U.S. Right. The reason why there's so many giant freeways is because there's lots of space.
Yeah, roads. Let's take a break. Kevin Marks, Matthew Ingram. We're talking Twig. Jeff has the week off. He'll be back next week. Our show today brought to you by Carbonite. Good thing to keep in mind. Your hard drive will die. And Carbonite's there to help you back it up. I want you to visit carbonite.com. CARBONITE.com. If you don't have... by the way, this is exactly how backup should be. It's automatic, right? So it's not like sometimes some backup program, we're going to... on a schedule every Sunday, we'll back. No, this is always backing up whenever you're online. Continuous, so you change a file immediately, it's backed up. And because, let's face it, a lot of data disaster is just from, you know, human error, trashing a file that you need. Having those versions there is great. It's also great and very important if you're bit by one of the crypto ransomware programs, Carbonite. In fact, there's a white paper on the Carbonite site about how Carbonite can help you not get bit by ransomware. If that hospital in Southern California had been using Carbonite, wouldn't have had a problem. Automatic, continuous, and finally, it's off-site. It's in the Carbonite cloud where your data is kind of on vacation. It's just relaxing. It's enjoying the climate-controlled data center, the attention of talented engineers around the clock, keeping your data safe. Should you need it, boom, bam, it's back. In fact, you can log on to a Carbonite account on any computer and see your stuff. Visit it. You can even use their free apps. And they are very big on security and privacy. That's paramount. So here's the deal. I want you to try it. Go to carbonite.com. Use our offer code TWIG. And even if you're taking advantage of some of their special deals, like right now it's 30% off for a limited time, you still can get 2 months free when you use the offer code TWIG on sign up. So this is a really good time to take a look at carbonite.com. Big savings and 2 months free. You got to back it up. There is no less expensive cloud storage out there. $60 a year for the single computer, the basic plan, unlimited data. That is Windows or Mac. That is a year. That's less than $5 a month. That's a really good deal for all the data you can back up. Carbonite.com. Use the offer code TWIG. You get 2 months free. That makes it even better. We thank Carbonite for their support of This Week in Google. I don't know what this means. Eric Schmidt has a new job. He has been appointed the chair of a new Defense Innovation Advisory Board. Actually, I think this is a great idea if he actually gets to do it. The idea is to help the Department of Defense act more like a tech company. 12 individuals who have successfully led large private and public organizations will be tasked with advising the Pentagon on areas that are deeply familiar to Silicon Valley companies: rapid prototyping, iterative product development, complex data analysis and business decision making, the use of mobile and cloud applications, and organizational information sharing. The Department of Defense is massive. The Pentagon is one of the world's largest office buildings.
Yeah.
They are faced with incredible organizational challenges. Not, by the way, military strategy, nothing like that. It's really just modernizing the office, which I think is a good thing. Did you watch any of the testimony yesterday in Congress?
I didn't. I saw tweets about it.
Yeah, that's all you need. Tweets.
Darryl Issa apparently doing good work there.
Yeah, good on him. He's a representative from your district, right?
No,
is he one of yours? Where is Darryl? Is he Southern California?
Republican.
The 49th California? District, wherever that is. Anyway, he's a good man. He'd asked the right questions. And I have to say, Director Comey, James Comey, the director of the FBI, maybe didn't really get all the right answers.
Yeah.
One of the things he admitted.
I'd like the heavy-wash shredder companies to put the shredding back together.
Yeah. Yeah, let's do that. Please, unshred this. Mr. Gorbachev, unshred this document. He admitted that they blew it. And I think that this, in the long run, this might hurt the FBI more than any argument about public safety or the sanctity of encryption. The FBI admitted, yeah, we changed the iCloud password because we thought that would work. We were wrong. Had they asked Apple, and Apple's been quick to say this, including yesterday in front of Congress, had they asked us, we would have just given them a copy of the iCloud backup. They could have just brought that iPhone into an area where it's already paired with the Wi-Fi. It would have backed itself up, and we would have gladly handed that data over. The FBI was too smart by half. And apparently that impressed members of Congress more than anything else. You mean you blew it, and now you want Apple to go fix your mistake?
That's
unfortunate, because that's... Well, that's the problem. It doesn't really get to the heart of the matter, which is, should phones be private or not? Should there be a Kalia-style back... I don't want to use the word backdoor. It's loaded. A Kalia-style interface for law enforcement into our phones, just as there is an interface for law enforcement into telecommunications.
And that's why if they were looking for, a case that would give them a precedent, they picked the wrong one, because this isn't...
They blew it.
Right, because they made the mistake that they're now trying to fix.
Stupid. What's going on there? is your wife? Is it raining in Florida?
Did you hear that noise?
And Mrs. Ingram is stuck in there, and
ice cubes going into a glass.
She's really like, I gotta get out. She's pacing the floor like a caged tiger.
Not exactly.
Oh, okay. I have a vivid imagination. Daryl is of Northern San Diego. Daryl is a representative for Northern San Diego, Carlsbad and Oceanside. I just looked it up.
But they kind of shot themselves in the foot, right?
Yeah.
What if they had chosen a case? Presumably there are many, not just this one.
Well, Cyrus Vance Jr., the district attorney in Manhattan, says, he testified to this as if this is a good thing. I happen to have 175 iPhones I'd really like help with. That was persuasive. Oh, no, yes, we could really use this, Congress.
That kind of craters the, it's just this iPhone.
Yeah. These guys got to get on the same page.
Yeah.
The issue of this case in Brooklyn where the judge, the magistrate said, no, mm-hmm. Apple doesn't have to do that. That's asking way too much.
That was fascinating.
Yeah.
I thought some of his arguments were really, really powerful.
He just laid it on the line. There's also the insight. I hope this doesn't get glossed over. Walt Mossberg pointed out that Apple does, in fact, have access to the entire contents of your iPhone if you use iCloud backup. And gladly, mm-hmm. gladly, we'll hand this over.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And as many times.
Yeah.
Many times.
So that might be something you want to keep in mind. I mean, it's hard on the one hand for Apple to say, well, we fight for your privacy. And on the other hand to say, but we have built in a mechanism we expect almost everybody to use that will make your data completely transparent. What is exactly Apple's point?
So there's a bunch of subtle points here.
Go ahead. Please explain to me, Mr. Marks.
So the point is that they are saying you're trying to weaponize the software update mechanism, and that's a bad thing.
I agree with that.
Because that will stop people using software updates.
And that's a general vulnerability in almost all software, is that the software update could always be used by the company that is, you know, my Microsoft Google, could always be used to get in to the stuff.
You know, there have previously been exploits that have basically been fake software update servers before they built good key signing changes.
There is now. On Macintosh, there's an updater a lot of companies use, including VLC, called Sparkle, that is an updating service that they use. It's, you know, it's open source. And in Sparkle, you have the choice of using HTTP or HTTPS. And a number of companies, including VLC, chose HTTP. So it's trivial to man in the middle of the software update.
Right.
And a software update essentially means we can do anything we want.
Right. So the point is they have to. So what they're arguing about is not so much the software side of it as the signing side of it, and saying you are forcing us to sign something that is yours rather than ours.
That's the free speech argument that you can't make us sign this.
Right.
Yes. And some of the debate was like, you know, what if you kidnap the Apple engineers? Could they do it? And the answer is no. You'd have to kidnap the person with the key.
Right.
And there's a revocation mechanism and so on. And when we get into like this sort of...
Hey, actually, that's an interesting question. I hadn't heard them say there's a revocation mechanism. If you can you use that? Because if you revoked it, wouldn't all the existing iPhones be unable to update? Aren't they expecting the signing key from Apple?
Yes, they are. So I think I'd have to... I don't know the exact protocol. There are protocols for saying this key is revoked. You need to go and fetch a new key.
That was built into Blu-ray. They've never invoked it, but that was one of the ways that the Motion Picture Association responded to the almost instantaneous cracking of DVDs content protection mechanism, CSS.
Yeah.
This time we're going to have a revocable key because last time we didn't.
Right. But it gets very messy. And, you know, we get into, you know, key distribution methods. And the problem is, how do I get to the next key? And when I've revoked that key, and then I've got to go and get... And, that gives you another surface for attack. And so,
and you raised a really good point, is if we can't trust software updates, no one will update. And that is a bigger security flaw than anything.
Right. And that's to some extent, that's the problem that, you know, Google has the opposite problem in that people don't install software updates because of the process for getting them is more complicated and involves carriers and things. Whereas Apple has built a straight path through to them, which means they can deploy software updates much more easily. So what that means is that it is often easier to hack Android phones because some of the exploits go unpatched in a large proportion of them. So there's a problematic trade-off there as well.
All right.
Some of the less informed stuff, people were saying, well, I can get my phone hacked in any shop in the high street. And it's like, well, you can, because they have a database of exploits for a set of phones so they can jailbreak them. But that isn't necessarily the same as this. And, you know, it doesn't, there aren't no, I don't, you know, I'm not sure, you have to ask somebody who knows more of me, but there aren't known good 0 days for that generation of iPhones, as far as I know, right. That particular case.
Right. Let me see here. Somebody just said that Slysoft is back, but I don't see it. I just went to anydvd.com, the Slysoft company that makes Blu-ray Ripper, and their page still says, due to recent regulatory requirements, we've ceased all activities relating to Slysoft. So, but somebody says that maybe they've got a way. Torrent Freak says there's a way back.
Torrent Freak says it's back.
Yeah, we'll have to see. Maybe they're trying to do under the radar, so we won't say anything because Hollywood might.
Popcorn Time is back, too.
Yeah, you can't win, can you? How about this? And I want you to try this, Kevin Marks. One of the problems with Tap to Pay, at least as Apple Pay and Google Pay and Android Pay and all these others are implemented, is even when I do that, I still have to enter my PIN code and say, do you want cash back? And it ends up being the same interaction, not less painful because of Tap to Pay. So now Google's trying hands-free payments. Is this an April Fool's joke?
Yeah, it seems dodgy to me.
So this is very much like the Apple Pay ad where you have to go through your wallet to find your Tap to Pay. So
it's very limited release.
Yeah, they're doing this in the South Bay. Well, I want you to try it, Kevin, at McDonald's and somewhere else in your area.
By saying your initials.
You say your initials.
Yeah, that's secure.
How does that work?
No one knows your initials, Kevin X Marks, KXM. I don't know what your middle initial is.
So is it voice recognition?
Must be voice recognition. Well, now you just gave it away, Kevin. KJM.
That's weird.
That doesn't seem like a very secure
system.
Also,
why Papa John?
Papa John's and McDonald's. Maybe this is, you think this is a joke? I mean, look at that URL. get.google.com/handsfree.
It's only March, though.
So what's the URL?
get.google.com/handsfree. It says it's secure. Full card details will not be shared. Once you complete a purchase, you'll receive instant notification on your phone.
There's a Google Commerce blog post.
It's an app. Let me go see. Google Play Hands Free. You can download the app. Oh, man. I got to install this on my... this is crazy.
For your next trip to the South Bay McDonald's.
Yeah, well, I might drive down tonight. Papa John's.
So it uses location services. Okay, asks for initials and then uses the picture to confirm your identity.
So you don't even use Tap to Pay? You don't even use your phone?
No.
So it's facial recognition by the...
So you say, yeah. I'll pay with Google at checkout. They have a camera. Oh, yeah, that's Leo. What's your initials?
They ask for your initials.
And if that matches, then they go, okay, thank you. We're going to debit that guy Leo's account.
All images captured by the hands-free camera are deleted immediately, it says.
What the
sure.
Okay, I'm installing it. Let's see what happens.
Okay, well, you have an assignment. You got to go to McDonald's.
Is there
tonight.
A Papa John's nearby? Or?
Is it McDonald's?
It's funny that they're doing it in Silicon Valley only.
Well, it makes sense. Dude. That's where they can try it.
Yeah.
It's where that's where their employees are. But
yeah.
The thing, you know. There was somebody.
They must have very strong confidence in their facial recognition, right?
Well, the thing is, it depends what you compare it to. I mean, like, credit cards in America are ridiculously insecure.
Right.
I can give my son my credit card and he goes shopping with it. And this was true when he was 15, you know. The physical possession of the thing with the magnetic stripe is the thing you're competing with here. So somebody did this thing of... imagine the pitch meeting for chip and pin. It's like swiping your credit card, but right. You have to stick it in there, and then it makes a bunch of funny noises at you, and it takes twice as long. It's like, why would anyone do this? And the reason is it's a second factor authentication, and it encourages people to have a second factor. But also, it's a the reason they want everyone to upgrade their point of sales is so that they can use Tap to Pay, because that's the thing they actually want you to use, which is that confirmation thing, and there are cards with that in. They're very few American banks issue them, but they're widely issued in Europe, and you can tap to pay with them.
Yeah, Canada. I've been using them for a year or more.
Yeah, so I mean, it's just America being behind a lot of this stuff.
Well, now we're ahead. Now we're way ahead.
But I remember this because, you know, we had Tap to Pay on the Android phone.
I know. Until Apple does it, it doesn't exist. I'm sorry.
But it was. I remember this because I saw the logo in the store, and I tapped my phone on the thing, and the person behind the desk was like, "What did you just do? Did you hack my tool?"
The cash register drawer just opened. Oh my god!
What happened?
What?
Like, oh, it's a thing. It's like there's a.
I was actually reluctant to use Tap to Pay for the longest time because for that exact reason, I thought they're not going to believe this.
But also, Samsung have done that thing where they
emulate the swipe.
Magnetic feel as if you were swiping it.
Yeah, they use a magnetic. That's what that original. What was the name of that card that I really thought was a bad idea? Where it actually did that. You had one card for all your cards. You'd press a button to choose the card, and then you'd swipe it, and it magnetically would change. Coin.
Yeah.
Coin. Yeah. Right.
Remember that?
Yep.
But that's what Samsung Pay does. Without that, it just kind of generates a magnetic field, I guess.
And I use Samsung Pay all the time.
Do you?
Yeah, and people go crazy over it. They're like, wait.
You can't do that. That's not a tap-to-pay terminal.
You can do that?
Yeah, because the terminals, it doesn't require any update by the hardware.
Which, by the way, if you're going to a store where they haven't updated the hardware to tap-to-pay.
Well, you know.
Right.
Petaluma.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, we still have a video. We still have a video store here. They have VHS tapes.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, this is another story. So
we had one, but I'm pretty sure it was a money laundering run.
Maybe it is here too. I don't know.
Did you see that post from KQED about Netflix? That was interesting.
KQED, our local public broadcasting station.
What about it?
So the challenge is that the problem is that Netflix is catalog is rotting. Now we know this about the streaming catalog is that there used to be more films available for streaming, and now there aren't, and they've lost a lot of the classic stuff.
Right.
But this is also true of their DVD and Blu-ray catalog too, because fewer people are using it, and they're not replacing the old discs.
Right.
So their sort of library ability is shrinking. So the more obscure art films or the older films that they only had a few copies of are falling out of the catalog because they're not replacing them, and they're not bothering to sign up rights to stream them because they're mostly signing up TV shows instead.
Right.
And they've stopped trying to be the...
It's just Netflix changing, isn't it? It's just becoming a different thing.
It's all about original content for them.
But it is a problem. The question is like, okay, so who is going to have that archive? These old
Your
films?
VHS store down the street.
Right. And there's this sort of weird thing where those stores are coming back. And part of it, there's also a structural thing, which is the doctrine of first sale, which is... If I buy a Blu-ray, I can rent it to you. That's allowed.
Right.
If I have a digital copy, I can't because there isn't a transferable license on those. And so they have to do a per studio negotiation, and the studios...
Could you buy a Blu-ray, rip it, put it on a USB key, and rent it that way? No.
No,
that'd be wrong.
Because it's a physical object.
Aren't there any sort of niche BitTorrents that are effectively, you know, this is all the weird...
Ask Kanye West. I think he knows how to find those.
Yeah, no, well, this is what's happening is that people are building like closed group curated things of, you know, like my uncle who's like in his 70s has signed up for this opera torrent site because he's into opera.
Right.
And
that's awesome.
You know, it's run out of Argentina and they have all the great opera
recordings. There's a great argument for BitTorrent is preserving this cultural heritage. It's just like the game ROM sites that are technically illegal. But they're preserving important artistic heritage.
And this is the Internet Archive argument, but a lot of what they're trying to do is digitize things proactively and then work out how they can do it out. So they do it with books. So they digitize out of print books. They also digitize in print books and lend them out as if they were a digital library and try and work out precedent there.
Right.
But it's hard to do for films. No, there's agreements they can do.
Public library, somebody's pointing out, Brian N.W. in our chair room, their public library often has Blu-ray and DVDs.
Yes. I'll try and find the article because
that's a very interesting point. Netflix
This was a film reviewer at KQED saying, "I can't get hold of these things anymore."
You know, I wanted to watch an old Steve Martin movie, and most of them are not streaming.
Yeah,
and you have to buy them.
Yeah,
yeah.
I tried. I remember when Robin Williams died.
Same thing.
I wanted to go and find all the Robin Williams stuff, and some of it was quite easy to find, but there were some that, you know, you really had to, there weren't that many people seating, there weren't, because until he died, they weren't actually that popular.
You couldn't even get them on BitTorrent. That's how hard they are to find.
Yeah, that's how
you can't even pirate them. Well, I think it's a strong argument for Internet Archive, but the problem is that there's far more stuff. He doesn't. I mean, at this point, I don't think he's saving a lot of old movies. He is doing. I think of it as Brewster Kahle, but what? They are preserving ROMs. No, they're preserving ROMs though.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, they do movies. There's what's that
video we saw of San Francisco? That was from the Internet Archive.
They have an archive of old films. There's the Prelinger Archive.
That's not like Hitchcock films. That's just some guy's home movies.
It's a collection of things that have got out of copyright and a collection of public information films and things like that.
Right.
So they've got like older stuff before copyright got extended to ridiculous lengths. And they've got things that fell out of copyright as well. But yeah, I think they want to digitize more and they want to be able to do this. But it's a challenge of working out what's actually practical and which order they attack these things in. But it is an issue anyway. So I put the link in the chat for the KQED one, which was explicitly about I'm trying to review this film that is cited as a classic, and I can't get a copy of it anywhere. Even the public library, and I had to go to the specialist San Francisco cult. Video store to get it.
Here's the good news. Mark Zuckerberg is denying that he is the commander of a VR army. The fact that he felt he had to respond to this is hysterical. This is the picture Mark posted on Facebook of him at the Samsung event where everybody in the audience, all the journalists, were looking at video on a VR headset. And he was able to just stride in, unencumbered by this vision of the future.
Great photo.
It says so much. Yeah. But the fact that he felt he had to respond to this, he did an interview with a German newspaper, Die Welt am Sonntag, and he denied enjoying the fact that he was seemingly commanding a VR army. He says, quote, "Nothing could be further from the truth. The exact opposite is the case." Boy, when they start denying it, that's when you know. What was on inside the headsets was a video of children playing soccer in some faraway place. You could look around and you could see the kids playing soccer around you. It was a shared experience with everyone in that place that would have been impossible to experience otherwise. They were enjoying
But the point is that he posted that shot himself. He didn't get it.
He still doesn't get it.
Did you see the video? There's a vine going around of a guy sitting there experiencing Oculus, and there's a girl sitting next to him, and she's got this look on her face. She's looking into the camera. Like, what am I even doing here? Because he's, moving. And
we
like
talked about this, what was this, on Twit last Sunday? About how you look like the Star Wars kid, the kid fighting with the lightsaber. When you're doing VR games, you look impossibly dorky. But you don't know it, because
it's next level.
It's next level dorky. It is as bad as it can get. And that's why, when you see on the cover of Newsweek, Palmer Luckey, the CEO of Oculus, going like this in his thing.
And I mean, this is going to be presumably interim technology, right? Like, magically, the whole promise of that is
plug it
things
in.
Just appear in your environment.
Yeah, plug it in.
You don't have to put on a ski mask.
You'll still look dorky when you're fighting aliens that only you can see.
It was a business insider. I'm trying to find it, but
That's all right. You can watch Twit on Sunday and see it. It was hysterical because she's going,
How epic it is inside the VR and how ordinary it is.
It's not so epic. Actually, gamers look bad. We've just gotten used to it. All gamers look bad. Droop, kind of slack-jawed. But this is worse. Hey, here's a tool I didn't know existed, and it's somebody's GitHub project. Turns out there's geolocation. I didn't know this in YouTube videos. So he's made a YouTube video geo search, where you can search your address and see what your neighbors are posting on YouTube. This seems like a troubling phenomenon.
I didn't even know that was possible.
There's exit like data in video streams, so they put location if the camera puts location in. So like if you shoot it on your phone.
Who knew that our video was posting, our neighbors were posting Mulchstock 2015, the largest peaceful lawn transformation on record. Who knew? That's an, that's this is down the street.
Actually, I could have guessed.
Mulch stock. Wow. This is wow. So there you go. And that, by the way, that address is long. Okay, I'm going to stop mulch stock right now. YouTube.github.io and then geo-search-tool.
Oh, great. Kevin put the link to the video. And she's a design researcher, VR researcher.
Yes.
Oh.
she's
this is the short version. This is the this is just the single vine. But it serves the purpose.
It's just the look on her face.
Definitely.
Yeah, she's certainly mugging to the camera there.
She's like, that's she's definitely deadpan. Just like, mm-hmm. He's like,
you can tell that's how you would feel.
That's how you look.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for you, it's a magical, miraculous experience.
Oh, man.
For everyone around you, they're going, oh, dear.
What a world we live in.
But the thing that Zuckerberg didn't get is that it is that photograph is the sort of perfect metaphor for Zuckerberg controlling what everyone sees. And he didn't see that.
You know, he didn't see it.
It is like, it's the Apple Lemmings ad from 1985.
You know? Yeah. It is literally.
Everyone's blindfolded except the one guy.
It is pretty much literally the Lemmings ad. All he needed was a hammer.
No, that's the Lemmings was the year after.
Oh, Lemmings, where they're marching off the cliff.
Yeah. They're marching off the cliff with blindfolds on. That's not 1984, because 1984, he's the guy on the screen. He's not the girl with a hammer.
Right. He's the other one. The people, I don't know. He's the guy who's not watching.
Today we celebrate the first anniversary of the Information Purification Directive. You know, that one. Yeah.
15,000 Vives sold in 10 minutes at $800 a pop.
Mm-hmm.
And that's 15,000 people are going to look really dorky to their girlfriends. 15,000. And this is much more expensive than Oculus.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
Did you say in front of their girlfriends?
Yeah. If they have them.
No comment.
They're imaginary girlfriends.
Well, they're boyfriends. Yeah,
it could be their boyfriends. Well, I feel like it's. Well, I don't know. I don't want to. Well,
someone also said is like, you know, what would actually make more sense if you built this into a motorcycle helmet, because A, then, you look less dorky, and B, then when you walked into something, you wouldn't hurt.
You
your
wouldn't
head.
Hurt. Yeah,
exactly. That's a good idea.
Somebody has made a motorcycle helmet with a heads up display in it, but not.
Yeah, it's actually fascinating.
It is. Yeah. I'm trying to get it because I want to. Yeah. The problem with that in all VR is you can't demonstrate it.
Scully. Exactly. Scully.
And Mulder?
Scully, that's it.
Yeah. Scully.
No, Scully's the company made the helmet.
Oh.
Yeah.
With a K.
Yeah.
That was Kickstarter, wasn't it?
Yep.
Crowdfunding.
Yeah, we're trying to.
And it was a demo. It was in lots of places.
Yeah, but when they build it, because we know the people who know them, because they were the electric, electric bicycle guys know the Scully guys.
Yeah.
It's a small community of strange people.
Strange two-wheeled people.
Strange two-wheeled people. All right, one last story, and then we're going to take a break. This is coming up later on Tech News Tonight, Tech News Today. Lindsay Turrentine, who wrote the piece in CNET about the last taco truck in Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually, I guess, dystopian fiction. But... I don't know. There used to be plenty of taco trucks in Silicon Valley. But then...
I need to get out of here soon because I just realized it's late. It's
you got a storm coming is what you got, dude. It is like you're gonna blow away in a moment. So let's take a break. Stay tuned for the discussion. TNT is just around the corner, about 8 minutes from now. Our show today brought to you by FreshBooks. Ooh, I love FreshBooks. Nice Canadian guys. You know them, Matt.
Mm-hmm.
They lived in your basement or I don't know. I've... No, he was in his basement doing this when you knew him in Toronto. Of course, they've grown a lot bigger. 5 million users later, it is the way to do your invoicing, to keep track of your expenses, to make sure you get paid faster. And man, you will love it come tax time because you're ready. The reports, you'll bring it to your tax person or if you do it yourself, you just go, nice job myself, because it is all there. Your cash flow is all in one place. You know exactly which invoices you sent, who's paid, when they paid, what your income is. You could take pictures of receipts with their beautiful app for iPhone, organize them for later. That means claiming expenses at tax time, or, you know, if you don't invoice for them, is easy. Same thing with the invoices. It's easy to invoice them. The best part about using FreshBooks, that zen feeling you'll have when tax time comes around, and you got it. You got this. You'll be glad you started using FreshBooks today. Go to freshbooks.com/twig. Don't forget to enter This Week in Google in the How Did You Hear About Us section and start your 30-day free trial today. freshbooks.com/twig. You will love it. And make sure you tell them you heard it on Twig so that they give us credit and help support the show. Kevin Mark, since you got to run, you want to give us a little tip or trick or tidbit or anything before you go?
Well, as always, there's Indie Webcamp events going on. There's an Indie Webcamp 2-day event coming up in Boston, well, Cambridge, MIT, the 14th and 15th of March. So put that on your calendars. And then there's also the regular Homebrew website clubs every other Wednesday. So indiewebcamp.com. If you scroll down to the bottom, there's the list of events there.
And I feel like we did two mitzvahs for Indie Webcamp. We did Ward Cunningham's Federated Wiki, which was started there, and now GNU Social. We are all in on the Indie Web.
Well, GNU Social, we're still working on making them more Indie Web friendly. The other news from that is that we're getting some of the Indie Web protocols validated by the W3C. So WebMention and MicroPub are
fabulous.
Going through the draft process at W3C at the moment in the Social Web Working Group. They've just been published this week.
Really good page at indiewebcamp.com, right at the beginning, the Get Started page. You'll find a link right on the front there. And it's a way that the things you can do to kind of support the idea of an independent web where you own your stuff. And it still lets you participate in the social web, absolutely. And I'm a plug for withknown.com because you kind of get it all if you have a withknown site. It's all there. Web hooks and everything.
That's all built in, yeah.
Yeah, love it.
Okay.
Thank you. Kevin, always a pleasure. KevinMarks.com.
Kevin.
He's off to that Hi, McDonald's guys. To try saying his initials and get a Big Mac.
I may do that when I come back.
You got to, dude. You got to.
I've got to go on the train now.
Get the app. Okay. Matthew Ingram, anything you want to give us a plug for? Anything you want to talk about? It's getting dark in Florida, folks.
It is getting dark, yeah.
When the lights go down on Biscayne Bay.
I can't think of anything.
You don't have to. You don't have to.
Have a thing.
Are you jealous that I'm sitting here with a Galaxy S7 in my hot little hands? And not just anyone. Gold. It is aggressively.
That is pretty sweet.
Aggressively gold. You know what?
You like it?
Yeah. Now, there's a few things that you have to get used to with Samsung.
Like what?
Physical home key. And then and it's a little annoying that the buttons, and by the way, they're capacitive on the metal, so that's cool. But they're reversed from how everybody else does it. The recents button is on the left and the back button's on the right.
That's
irritating. Yeah, if you're a Sammy user, you probably just kind of, you get used to it. Fingerprint reader is very good. Man, is it a gorgeous screen, 5.5 inches. And while
it even looks nice from here.
Isn't it? Yeah. Even on Skype, it looks good. That's how good it is. Man, is this camera good. Oh, my goodness gracious. One F1.7, which means you're getting amazing images that rival DSLR. I mean, this thing, and
that is pretty amazing.
This is low light here. I mean, we're in a restaurant.
That clarity through the glass was
clarity
great.
Is incredible.
That is pretty good for low light.
And low light, OIS. So this is our TD station. Here's Anthony Nielsen running the board for TNT. I took the same picture with a Leica Q. And, you know, if I put them side by side, you'd be hard-pressed. You'd have to really do a lot of pixel peeping to tell the difference.
How big is the screen?
5.5 inches, but because of the bezel-free sides, you know, the edge goes over the edge. It actually feels very compact in the hand. It's a great way to get a giant phone without having it feel like a giant phone. The other negatives are this edge, and I've had this problem with the S6 edge as well. Because it goes around, it's there's nowhere to hold. So
you activate it by mistake?
Yeah, you can get stray. You have to kind of learn how to hold it like flat palm, which is a little weird. I don't use this edge mechanism that, but you maybe you'd like it. To me, this seems like a silliness, but you know, Samsung always has to do something that makes it different than every other Android device, which of course means it's not going to be updated as fast. But it is Marshmallow. It's 6.01. Yeah,
Apple has that now on the. I've got an iPad, and I'm constantly going to flip a page in Flipboard or something. And swiping out a menu from the right hand side, you know, because it wants to offer you the ability to do two things at once, pull something open in the menu on the side. So I'm triggering that thing accidentally like half a dozen times a day.
It's so funny because I have the opposite. I can never get it to swipe over when I want to.
Only when you don't want it.
It's only when you don't want it. Yeah. No, I'm. You know what? It's way too early. I've only had it since Monday, but battery life looks pretty good. It's a big battery. They increased it considerably over the battery on the S6. So I'll have a better idea of how good the battery is in a few days. But so far, you know, it's honeymoon still. We're still in the honeymoon. But boy, is it pretty, isn't it? Oh, and I love this always on. So LG's doing this too now because you got an OLED screen. You can actually there's time and date and notifications. Are always on. It's like
all the time.
All the time. Hmm. And actually, I really like that. It's very useful.
I like I have an LG G3.
G4 or G3, yeah.
It's a G3 because I smashed my Nexus 6 and haven't got the screen replaced. So I got a G3 for $0 from my phone company.
You know what?
I do like the LG, the tap that makes the screen come alive if you just want to check the time or see what the battery life is or see what a message is. But I think that's a great feature.
Yep. Yep. I feel like, you know, here's the deal. We have great choice now. A lot of people just choose the iPhone because that's the default. You can't go wrong. Choose an iPhone. But I believe that we have excellent choices. And I have to say Samsung is just making some really beautiful hardware. Couldn't be happier. But that wraps it up. Thank you, Matthew Ingram, for joining us. Fortune.com. Matthew's writing is a must read every single day. He writes longer, thoughtful pieces now, and I'm really glad that they have you doing that because they're great.
Great. Well, thanks. Yeah. And if anybody, Fortune.com or at Matthew I on Twitter.
If you got any big scoops. And, oh, don't forget.
Or even small scoops.
Don't forget. He's also on Quitter.no.
Exactly.
The worst name ever. Quitter. You're a quitter? Okay. Yeah, I quit. Yeah.
Twitter quitter.
I'm a Twitter quitter. Oh, I get it. Is that what it is?
I don't know, but that seems like it should be a show title.
Oh, Twitter quitter. Oh, interesting.
But it sort of defines what you are.
Yeah, I don't want to be a quitter.
Not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I might start my own. You can join it.
I do want these things to work. I was going to say to
Me
Kevin,
too.
He's so passionate about this stuff, and you know, I get caught up in his passion and I also want things to be open and federated. It's just really, really hard to get people to go and use those things. And so then no one's there except people who already agree that that's a good thing.
I know. In some ways that's not bad. I had some of the best conversations in the early days of Google Plus, in the early days of FriendFeed, in the early days of Jaiku, in the early
days. So great.
I loved FriendFeed.
So good. Yeah. And you're right, the smaller groups are sometimes better. Yeah. You have a better discussion.
I think we need to have, just as we do in real life, big venues and little venues.
Mm-hmm.
You can use Quitter.no without quitting Twitter.
And in a way, you know, I wish if Twitter had not, I wrote a thing not that long ago about the Twitter that might have been, and could we get the Twitter that might have been back, the one that was federated, the one that was, you know, open API and was just anyone could sort of put in or pull out. And I think it's too late, but I kind of wish if they hadn't been going for the IPO and all that, what could it have become? What things could they have developed that would have solved some of these problems?
It's a bittersweet end to a very good show. Thank you, Matthew.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and you have place on your couch if Donald Dump becomes the president. I can move up there, right?
Yeah, sure. I've actually been having a lot of inquiries.
Did you see that? It's Google searches for how do I move to Canada spiked after Super Tuesday.
It's not actually as easy
No, it's hard.
Some people would like it to be, but
it's hard. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to stick around. I think the fireworks should be fun. Thank you, Matthew. Thank you, everybody. Right. We do This Week in Google every Wednesday, 1:30 p.m. Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 21:30 UTC. Please join us live. It's fun to watch live. We can chat in the chat room. But if you can't do it live, of course, on-demand audio and video of all of our shows, always available, twit.tv. In this case, twit.tv/twig. And don't forget, the shows are always available on the internet in such a huge number of ways. You really get your choice. We have apps. We didn't write any of them. Great apps on all the platforms, iOS, Android, Windows Phone, Roku, Chromecast, 5 Apple TV apps. I mean, they're everywhere. And, of course, every platform has a podcatcher, an app that allows you to listen to podcasts or downloadable shows. And so find your favorite. We like Overcast on iOS and Android. Pocket Cast is good. Download the app and subscribe to Twig. That way you won't miss an episode. It'll always be on your phone or your device ready to listen to. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time on This Week in Google. Bye-bye.